Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foyt, joined by Matt Kinnear and Jeff Shannon. It is Wednesday, so we are wrapping up the Division I college fall ball conversation. We've got a couple of Patriot League teams we're going to dive a little deep into to start. Matt was at practice with the midshipmen of the Naval Academy last week, and Jeff, you visited with the Loyola Greyhounds last week as well. Let's start with the Greyhounds because Navy also is coming off of a weekend in which they scrimmaged High Point, so maybe that conversation will go a little bit longer. And, you know, for me, G-Shan, when you talk about the Greyhounds, it starts with Patrick Spencer. What did you take away from Spencer's performance in practice and what else you saw from the offense?
Yeah, so this is the second time I've gotten to see them a little bit this fall. The first was through Zach's, our media editor's videos during his visit to the Rutgers. A little bit for Spencer is an extension of that. He looks primed to be a top checked Turnbull Award nominee towards the end of the season and a potential Tewarton candidate. There's no one that I've seen that has his vision, his size, his dodging ability, and his ability to set up his fellow teammates for success. And just from the brief scrimmage and from the videos I was able to watch, he will continue to do that and be one of the top players in NCAA lacrosse.
And who will flank him? I mean, obviously, with Alex McGovern's emergence last year, he played a lot of attack, right? He was a lefty attackman on that unit, filling in for Zach Harawires. But, you know, my understanding is that there's some desire to get him running out of the midfield. And then with the influx of a couple of high-profile attackmen in Aiden Olmstead and Kevin Lindley, I would think that, you know, there's at least a little more versatility and few more options at the attack than might have previously been expected.
Yeah, so McGovern was injured for the scrimmage, so I didn't get to see him play, but just talking with the team a little bit, they are expecting him to contribute, but imagine more as a midfielder with this crew. In the scrimmage, the way that the teams were kind of split up, we're not what we saw at Rutgers. Rutgers, you had Spencer playing with the young guys, Lindley and Olmstead. Here, they kind of, the way that the rosters kind of split those guys up a little bit. So, but within that crew, I still expect Lindley and Olmstead to be contributors. Actually, I thought Bobby Alston played really well in the scrimmage, and from what I talked with those guys, he seems to be making a case for playing time as well with that group. Lindley is really good at the position he plays. Olmstead, I would say, is a little bit more versatile. So I can see a situation where Lindley is more your traditional lefty shooter. Olmstead maybe plays a couple different spots for them. So they got a lot of talent. I would also expect the midfield to kind of come around and be more of an offensive threat and actually working probably a little bit more off of Spencer this year than we've seen in the past. Under Brian Sherlock and Romar Dennis and those guys, there's a lot of initiation up top. I expect them to work a little bit more with Spencer and contribute off assists and stuff from him.
We mentioned some freshmen, and when you shift to the other end of the field, it feels like there's an infusion of new talent, but they come in the form of two guys who were injured through their freshman year and really didn't see the field. Were you able to take anything away from John Raley and Ryan McNulty's performance?
I think the guy who stood out most was McNulty. He was definitely playing a lot more pole than close defense. He was not afraid to run upfield. He played offense extensively a couple times. They weren't afraid to let him drop down and run around there, working off some guys. So it's good to see. If you're a Loyola fan, it's good to see those guys running around and adding some depth to that defensive defensive close and defensive midfield unit.
This is a Loyola Greyhound team that's coming off of a Final Four appearance in 2016 and lost 7-4 in Columbus in the first round of last season's NCAA tournament after really turning it on late in the year. What did you take away, aside from personnel, from being around the Greyhounds last week?
It's interesting. It definitely is Pat Spencer's team, I think, more than anything else. You're going to see guys like John Duffy and Jay Drapow contribute a lot more offensively this year, working off those guys defensively. Again, it's been interesting following the Grant Lamone and Jacob Stover battling for that. Silver looked awesome in the scrimmage. And again, it's nice to have some depth there. You know, a big question for them will be how their faceoff unit, their actual faceoff midfielder position shakes out. Graham Savio's gone. His brother, Bailey, is a top prospect at that position. But I imagine this year it's going to be a little bit more Mike Orefice.
Orefice.
That's right. Yeah, I was asking SID Ryan Engelbrody.
I think you'd probably be able to get away with just saying like Mike Fettuccini or something.
Yeah, I imagine he'll be the faceoff man of today with Bailey contributing and kind of prepping him to be more of the faceoff man for tomorrow. So they look deep. I mean, they look competitive. I know from their perspective, they thought they went toe-to-toe with Rutgers in that scrimmage. And if we consider Rutgers a top 10 team, that's a good sign for them. So I can't imagine any other team in the Patriot League being favored to win that title. And I imagine Loyola again being a threat in the NCAA tournament with a potential Final Four run.
Matt, let's head 30 miles south down Interstate 97 to the yard. You got an opportunity to take in a practice for Rick Soule and his staff. And let's start with the Bricks, because that's where you started with your true fall ball write-up that appeared on InsideLacrosse.com on Tuesday. Make sure to check that out. What are the Bricks all about?
Brick by brick, baby. You know, it's the thing that Coach Rick Soule, you know, he kind of partially, you know, Brady Dove was talking about something he did in his training for his assignment, you know, where they kind of carried this tube with them when they were working out and how, you know, it got heavier throughout the workout. But then he also watched the Dunbar High School 30 for 30, and, you know, they carried these bricks with them when they work out. So Rick kind of, you know, took that and made it its own. And, you know, these guys carry these bricks with them. They have their number on them. They carry them wherever they go on a team activity. Obviously, they can't carry it, you know, around the academy when they're going to classes and stuff like that, because there's uniform codes and things like that. But they carry with all their team activities, and it, you know, represents a number of things for the program, you know, notably the blue-collar aspect that, you know, they strive for at Navy Lacrosse. The foundation that they're building for the spring is really the big part of it, the foundation that's been laid, you know, prior to them, and just the discipline. It's, you know, of kind of carrying this around with you all the time. You know, and I think it just represents a broader look at the Navy program in terms of, I feel like they've freshened up practice. They're doing things a little bit differently. You know, I've been to practice at least five times over, you know, the last 5 or 6 years or so. And this one just felt more different. You know, the drills were slightly different and everything they did. They tweaked everything. You know, I thought Coach Soule was a little more demanding of his players in terms of getting in there and taking moments where he really pointed out things that he wanted to change on the field. You know, maybe the expectations are a little bit higher. I just felt a little bit of an air of change around the entire practice.
This was a team that made it to the NCAA quarterfinals in 2016 and had a disappointing 2017, due in large part to injuries. In this staff's tenure, their identity when they've been successful has been built from the defensive end forward, and they graduate a couple of stars in Chris Fennell and Matt Reese. And I'm curious as to what you saw from the defense. You know, senior Hiram Carter is the returning starter down low. What are they going to look like at the defensive end of the field?
You know, honestly, this might not make sense to people, but I think even graduating those two star players, the defense is going to be better, I think. You know, they kind of took a step back last year and were ranked 22nd in the country in scoring defense, which really shocked me when I was looking up that stat. You know, you expect Navy defenses to be top 10 defenses in the country. You know, that's what Ryan Wallner has kind of built there.
Well, and particularly on that raw databases, because the other factor to consider is that Navy, while they can have short possessions offensively, tend to be a team paced in the bottom half of Division One. So, you know, that has been an asset for that raw scoring defense. I'd be curious, when you're talking, I'll look up and see what their defensive efficiency was.
You know, so one thing I didn't note in my piece was how they started the fall session later this year than they normally do. You know, I think it was like a week later. And part of that was Coach Soule said he wanted the seniors to set the tone, not the coaching staff. And I think when you see this defense, it's a very senior-laden defense. You already mentioned Carter. You know, he's just a mean guy. He had that just that mean, you know, hard check, chip on his shoulder kind of vibe to him. You have Stephen Hinks. He has, you know, just a really big guy, Michael Strack. You know, so it could be a trio of close defensemen who are senior leaders on this team. So I think the seniors really are setting the tone. And it's a tone of selflessness. You know, last year, it just felt like the defense was playing as a bunch of individuals, a lot of guys trying to do a little bit too much, not quite playing as a unit. And the strength of this defense is in the strength of any good defense is in the unit. I think you're not going to see, you know, maybe none of these guys are all Americans at the end of the year, but I think the defense is going to be better. And I think it's kind of that senior leadership, that selfless ethos. You know, there's a lot made of the Ohio Machine defense, you know, the faceless men that they called them. You know, I think you're going to see that vibe here with Navy. In addition to those guys, Ryan Kern, he had a rough year last year in terms of, you know, he had a foot injury where, you know, when I was talking to the guys at practice, you know, there were times that he had to be helped off the field by his teammates after games. He played the games and did the best he could, but his foot was bothering him so much that he had to be helped off the field because he couldn't walk on his own. And he was playing goalie under those conditions. He started every game last year. He had that Hopkins game, you know, which we're going to talk about this rivalry, where the hidden ball trick kind of is just a shake to the confidence to happen early in your playing career. But he looked great in practice. Short-range shots, long-range shots, he was kind of gobbling up everything. He was really comfortable directing traffic. I think with him and then these kind of faceless seniors on this defense, they're going to take a big step forward.
To follow up on some of those numbers, Navy ranked 48th in pace last year and 36th in adjusted defensive efficiency, which accounts for the pace that you play at and the quality of your opposition. From your write-up, one thing that stood out to me that I really liked, if I'm a Navy fan, is you look at your top two short stick D middies, they can be the bellwether for your unit as to whether, you know, those are the guys that are going to get attacked. And in DJ Plummer, who's 6'3", and David Jones, who's 6'4", that's a big pairing. And regardless of how healthy you are or how in or out of shape you are, there's no replacement for size. And if at the very least they're difficult to get around because they're so big and rangy, you know, before you include that athleticism, that goes a long way. And then the last note is, you know, Jeff Durden is a plebe who I've been a fan of for 3 years. I think he's a really special player. And so I can see the seeds of it coming together. And I agree with you that it might be a surprise to Navy fans, particularly given how, you know, the profile that Fennell and Matt Reese had at the end of their careers.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I talked so much about these seniors, but, you know, the plebes, Nick Franchuk was the guy who really kind of stood out most in terms of defensive end. You know, I could definitely see him getting a spot somewhere on the field. You know, he's from Fairfield College Prep in Connecticut, so he's kind of got a lineage of success and coaching and knows how to play. Jeff Durden was just great. You know, the size of this, you know, I think you could have maybe 5 of 6 guys on the field who are 6'3" or bigger at one time for this defense. So I think you got a lot to like if you're a Navy fan. I think a lot of people are going to be doubting them because of these losses, but you know, they've been building something special from the defensive end, and it's not just going to go away with two players.
At the other end of the field, Casey Reese returns from injury.
Casey Reese is just one of those special people. You know, this is the Naval Academy, where it's just exceptional people throughout. And the doctors, the trainers at the academy were just, they'd never seen anything like it in terms of someone's recovery like this. So that really says something. And, you know, the way that him and Grayson Chirain played off each other, and I brought this up with Coach Soul, and he agreed with me, is Grayson's so quick, so athletic, he gets around people, he gets in open space. Casey is just like, I'm going to bury someone. You know, I love the contact, I'm going to run into you, I'm going to go into traffic. They really work well off each other, but man, Reese is just, he's a special player when you think of how seamless his recovery has been. He was the best player on the field at practice, I'd say fairly easily. And, you know, 10 months ago, he was undergoing surgery and his, you know, future playing career was in doubt. You know, it's pretty special.
Well, Jeff and Matt, thank you for bringing us up to speed on the most recent fall all-access pieces, Loyal Greyhounds and Navy Midshipmen. If you want to hear more, check back to last Wednesday's podcast and make sure to check InsideLacrosse.com for all of the true fall ball action and write-ups. And we will be back next week with something. We don't know what yet, but something's going to happen. And we'll be back to talk about all the schedule releases right after this quick break. Matt, did you have a good Halloween?
I had a wonderful Halloween.
You probably ate a lot of candy.
Of course.
Probably struggling with too many Reese's peanut butter cups in your belly. Well, I know someone's got the solution for that, and it's Blue Apron, the United States' #1 fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service. whose mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And it achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. By virtue of their home chef community, they help enable you to cook healthier meals, which is exactly what the doctor ordered for the day after Halloween. And they've established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. That's how they have created this more sustainable food system. And because they ship the exact amount of ingredient required for the recipe to you, it reduces waste. This is the best part. This is literally the best part of every single one of these live reads. The upcoming meals that are featured include cheesy chicken and black bean enchiladas with salsa verde, shrimp marinara with spaghetti, spinach, and parsley, maple gravy smothered pork chops with stewed collard greens and sweet potatoes, spiced cauliflower and pepper with jasmine rice and cilantro yogurt sauce. That cilantro yogurt sauce is... it gets my attention every time. I've heard a lot of Blue Apron on other podcasts that I listen to in recent days. And whenever I hear cilantro yogurt sauce, I'm like, man, I could just... There's literally probably nothing that I wouldn't eat that with, minus maybe a Reese's peanut butter cup. Blue Apron is affordable for less than $10 per person per meal. It delivers these seasonal recipes with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. And that also helps to fill out your recipe book so that you have a lot of ideas for how to make new meals going forward. It's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, like I said, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less, and it's guaranteed. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook or them like it right. Check out this week's menu and get $30 off your first meal with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/lacrosse. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/lacrosse. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Matt, the story of last week was all about Navy and Johns Hopkins releasing their schedule in synchronized fashion in order to, I would imagine, get out in front of the reaction, which was probably going to be largely negative, to the fact that they are not playing each other. And we learned subsequent to the schedule release that they are not just playing each other for the 2018 season, but also for the 2019 season as well. I just want to set the table. The reason that this is happening is because of conference realignment. Conference realignment is nearly a decade-long process. It kind of started in men's lacrosse in an insulated way. Really, the Big East existed in college football and basketball, but it did not exist in men's lacrosse because of Syracuse's desire to stay independent. So the other Big East programs were kind of spread across other conferences. Notre Dame played in the GWLL, Rutgers played in the ECAC, etc. When Syracuse's NCAA tournament hopes started to become a little bit more tenuous, particularly in that 2007 season, the idea of the automatic qualifier, aka the second bite at the apple, became a little bit more appealing, and that catalyzed the creation of Big East Lacrosse. In 2013, we saw the expansion of the Patriot League through Loyola joining as an all-school team, all-school program, and Boston University adding men's lacrosse. So now in 2013, the Patriot League has 9 teams, which is its own onerous and unique factor. The realignment of the ACC in 2014 and the departure of Maryland in 2015 has continued to create the formation of the Big Ten, obviously, in 2015 was significant there as well. It's just created all these scheduling dynamics that have thrown traditional games into upheaval in terms of whether or not those reserved weekends are still available. For example, Johns Hopkins and other Big Ten schools now have the last 5 Saturdays of the college lacrosse season reserved for Big Ten games. It's a byproduct of the creation of Big Ten lacrosse, which I think most people agree is a positive for the sport at large and certainly for the 6 members. I think last NCAA tournament pretty clearly showed that it's a value prop, a very positive value prop for the 6 members as well. But these scheduling difficulties are the byproduct. And as I said, you know, for Navy, so because the Patriot League has 9 teams in it, you have to play 8 games because right now they play every other opponent. But every team has 1 bye week because there's an odd number of teams, right? So you can't have five matchups like you would if there was 10 teams, or four matchups like you would if there was eight teams. And it so happens that Navy's is the last weekend of the regular season prior to the Patriot League tournament, which is a week before eight of the Division I men's conference tournaments. And what I'm saying is that Navy is in a very unique position with respect to their schedule. I noted last year, I believe it was last year, although it might have been in 2016 and my memory has faded, that if they missed the Patriot League tournament, their last regular season game, because they do not play the week between the Patriot League tournament and the first round of the NCAA tournament the way that Colgate plays Syracuse and BU plays Duke and Army plays Notre Dame. Navy doesn't play that weekend. Their last game would have been, I believe, either April 18th or April 21st, that Army game in 2016, if they had missed the Patriot League tournament or Army game last year, whatever it was, which is crazy. But what it means is that for 2 years, we saw Navy Johns Hopkins played in February. How'd that go?
Well, they were great games.
Well, one was a great game. One was a great game. The other produced great highlights.
Correct. One was a great double overtime game in front of a whopping 665 people. The other was a great game that people on TV got to watch and produced probably the biggest or one of the top five biggest highlight reel moments of last season with Joel Tinney's hidden ball trick goal. So from that aspect, went great. But from the experience of the fans, not so great. You know, and I think you look back at what makes Johns Hopkins versus Navy special, what makes Army versus Navy special, what makes Maryland versus Navy special. Is it the fact that it's Johns Hopkins on their jersey, or is it the experience that goes along with it? I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it's more the experience that goes along with it. You know, this, you know, I think back in 2004, there was 10,000 people at Hopkins versus Navy game. A game with 665 people played in terrible conditions is not a great experience for anybody. So really, like when you're looking at the, like, you know, when you're lamenting this local rivalry kind of going by the wayside, really it already has. The experience has already been reduced to, you know, an afterthought in terms of the college lacrosse season anyway. You know, obviously I think Army-Navy, they could play that game in a back alley any day of the week and it would still be a once-in-a-lifetime experience for these kids. But really, you know, the experience has already been sucked out of it. So I know we're lamenting the loss of it, and it's an unfortunate byproduct of a number of circumstances, but it wasn't going to be a great experience if it was going to be played in February.
Navy plays at Maryland on February 10th. Johns Hopkins hosts the Towson Tigers the same day. I think that there are a couple of factors at play. The way that I read how these schedules turned out and infer how the conversations must have gone between the two coaching staffs as it related to making the decision that we just can't play in 2018 and 2019, I think it became clear that Hopkins needed to move Towson to the front of their schedule. The Blue Jays were coming off of a loss to the Tigers in 2017. And so when that game got moved up, it made it very problematic to find a whether it was a midweek spot or even you know, another early season Saturday to play Navy on. I think Hopkins considered or offered to play Navy on a midweek in early March. I think it was like March 13 or 14. They ended up nominally replacing the midshipmen with Delaware, who they play on March 17th. That is the day that Navy plays Loyola. It is one of the pivotal Patriot League games, both in terms of, I mean, really everything. You know, who knows what position either team is going to be in and how important that game's going to be. You know, when that game's been played in Annapolis, it's served as a big win for Navy. When it's been played in Baltimore, it's served as a house of horrors for the midshipmen. So you can understand them not wanting to play on a short week. And I think that, you know, that really kind of emerged as one of the few options that they could have taken. And for Navy to say yes would have been a really difficult task. And I think that that's kind of the calculus from the Hopkins perspective as to why it didn't come to fruition. And, you know, from Navy, it might have been kind of a binary Hopkins Maryland thing, but even then, maybe not Hopkins, because that's when they booked their Towson game. You know, who knows? I don't know the order that these decisions were made, but given that they're playing Maryland on that day, I feel like the, you know, hands were tied in terms of what the available options are. And I think that more than anything else, it suggests for an overall need for overhaul, for reform.
Definitely. You know, there's, I don't know if there's what the perception is out there from the public about, you know, how seriously these decisions are taken among the coaching staffs. But, you know, I was actually the fall practice we've talked about today. I was there the day after that this news came out, and talking with Coach Soule, him and Coach Petromala labored over the schedule for many, many hours to find a way to make this work, and it just didn't work. It's not like they said, oh, that weekend isn't there. You know, let's just give it up. Teams were willing to drop other teams, you know, but it just didn't work out for the other team. So there was a lot that went into this that was, you know, really trying to make this thing work, because people understand the history and the nostalgia for many things in the sport and want to keep it going. And, you know, like I said, it's a great experience for the athletes when it is played at the highest level, you know, in terms of the most fans and the biggest atmosphere. But, you know, there's so many factors at play with this. And Terry, I think you and I, you wrote a great piece a year ago or 2 years ago about just the start date of lacrosse. It's something that we did a whole issue about playing lacrosse in
February. An award-winning issue,
Folio award-winning issue for that one. And there's just, you know, maybe this is going to be the catalyst, you know, these kind of beloved
it won't be
rivalries.
It won't be. I mean, okay, so here's the thing, right? In order for the sport to have a significant schedule change, there's essentially three things I think that could happen, or ideally, all of them could happen. The first is a universal start date, whether it's for just games or practice and games, which I would prefer. The second is moving the season later into June off of Memorial Day weekend, which I advocate for. And the third is narrowing the window of allowable regular season contests scheduled, which right now is between 12 and 17. And the flexibility that gives programs to avoid midweek games or schedule midweek games or avoid two in a three-day weekend or to do, you know, play two games in 3 days, like that variety is what it's funny because it's almost it's a similar analogy to the pace of play argument. Like, do we want coaches to be allowed to play fast if they want to play fast, or play slow if they want to play slow, or do we want to encourage something that is the most exciting and the most conducive to building a bigger fan base? At Inside Lacrosse, we generally shade toward the latter. We want something that is more engaging, more exciting, more amenable to fans. And my argument has been that as the emerging spring sport that folks throughout the sports media industry and the sports world say, you know, this could be football in the spring, well, then we need to make it easier by making these logical choices, whether it be with rules and saying, you know, we need a shot clock that is easy for folks to understand if we're going to have a shot clock. You know, we need to make sure that games are played in what is most likely to be better weather than most likely to be worse weather. And we need to make sure that the best matchups take place on the most meaningful weekends. And we need to not compete with folks going to the beach on our crescendo weekend or for our crescendo event. And that's the argument that I'm bringing to the table, you know, in an overarching way. The problem is the NCAA is too big to care about something as small as lacrosse, and the stakeholders within the sport either don't agree that the arguments I'm making are worthwhile or are problems that need to be solved, or can't come to a consensus on the best course of action to solve them. And so, in addition to the fact that at least the issue of when the season ends is decided through 2022 by virtue of the games being played in East Hartford, Connecticut, the NCAA championship weekend being played in East Hartford, Connecticut in 2021 and 2022, you know, we're committed for the next five seasons as to the end date of the season. I don't have any faith. I don't have any confidence. I don't have any belief that things are going to change until there's a more systemic change to the leadership structure within the sport.
Well, I mean, that's bold in terms, but
I'm not making any friends with that claim.
You're not. But it's. I mean, what percentage of kind of the coaches of the stakeholders of the people involved in the sport think that something needs to be? Is it an aspect of they don't think anything needs to change, or is it an aspect of we're not going to address it? We're just going to keep kind of passing the buck.
It's a combination of the two. Let me start by saying that the body who can control this is the Men's Coaches Association, mm-hmm. right? And this is similar to what we saw the Women's Coaches Association undertake with respect to recruiting reform, in the sense that
they're very powerful. They have a lot of autonomy.
They essentially are the only point of influence, and they can then in turn be influenced or work collaboratively with other entities. I think that for D2 and D3 programs, particularly those in the South, almost none of what I laid out is an issue that affects them. And by virtue of that, very few of them are willing to spend political capital on it. This is a North-South issue in a way that baseball experienced with its schedule as well. Among the Division I programs, not only is it geographically divided, there's a little bit of new school, old school mentality. There's a little bit of big school, small school mentality, in the sense that, you know, for the bigger programs, they're most likely going to be dictated to by their conference. They're the ones that have the most to lose and gain at the gate, but so few of them actually have meaningful gains and losses at the gate that it doesn't really matter compared to how important it is to win on Saturdays, qualify for your conference tournament, make it to the NCAA tournament, and then hope something good happens. Whereas at the small schools, you know, there's probably, with the exception, you know, you've spoken fondly about being at Marist for the MAC championship game a couple years ago and how amazing that environment was. You know, that's kind of the exception that proves the rule. And so as a result, there's less capital and less willingness, less equity, you know, for some of those northern mid-major D1 programs to argue toward this. Scott Maher has been at Albany, has been the most vocal by a country mile on the need to move games out as much as possible of February. Obviously, their game travel has been horrendous. They've experienced that in the NCAA tournament as well, so certainly there's a catalyst there. But he also talks about Albany's access to an indoor practice facility and how disadvantaged they are because they have to travel, what, like 30 minutes to get to the closest indoor practice facility? They don't have one on campus. That's another function. If you're a coaching staff that has an indoor practice facility, you're going to care less about this issue than you would if you didn't, if you had to shovel. And so we've seen an increase in influx of Division I programs that have indoor practice facilities as well. So again, there's so much about this that is an individualized perspective. It's not as overarching or communal as the rules, right? And it's not as systemically jeopardizing as fans getting turned off because the game seems slow and overcoached, and we don't have, you know, a crescendo moment like the 6-5 overtime 2010 national championship game to galvanize public opinion against this problem that had arisen out of a variety of factors. You know, if there was that moment, it was the 2016 Navy Hopkins game that, you know, was played in front of 600 fans, but it had 20,000 people watching the Patriot League digital network live stream. So, you know, I'm not arguing that it's something that is easy to comprehend or that there's going to be like a lot of momentum behind this issue. But if we're not putting the marquee matchups, number one, if the marquee games are not being played because of scheduling conflicts, and if the best matchups are not being reserved for the best weather, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face with respect to building future fan bases. These are the games that 8-year-olds attend and fall in love with the sport because of the environment that they're a part of. And they attend them because their families think that it's really fun. You know, it's a 71-degree day in April. You've been cooped up in the house for the last 3.5 months. You finally get out. You're at this environment with, you know, thousands of other people. You're smelling the hot dogs, all that sort of stuff. And it's just what lacrosse is supposed to feel like. And in a lot of ways, I think D1 has ceded the ground to high school lacrosse with respect to those game day environments. I think that across the country, not only is it easier to get to a high-profile high school matchup, but those are more fun. I'm not saying that every high school team's crowds have seen an influx, but I do think particularly in the regions of the country where there are a lot of options for Division I men's lacrosse, you know, those crowds aren't doing that great. The seasons are ending in late April, and there's still a month's worth of high school lacrosse that people go to.
You know, it's one other thing that I think is at issue here. You know, there's so many different pieces of this kind of scheduling debate, and it affects every program, like you outlined, you know, whether you're North, South, whether what facilities you have, what your travel situation, it affects you so much differently. You know, look at a school like Notre Dame. They have 10 regular season games last year.
11. Yeah.
11 regular season games last year.
And the minimum is 12, and then they were able to not schedule that 12th because they knew that if they didn't make the ACC tournament, they were going to get a 12th game in addition to it.
So, you know, how can we have, you know, a disparity of four games of regular season play between, you know, one institution and another? And it's not, you know, I'm not pointing the finger at Notre Dame. Obviously, they have concerns of their own. They're, you know, one of the westernmost schools in the country.
And they have a really strict policy on missing class for traveling for games. And I think that my argument there is, well, we just need to be as creative as possible. And if there aren't that many solutions, then you have to take advantage of the solutions that are available to you. So, you know, if you're Notre Dame, the other ACC programs probably aren't going to want to hear this from an RPI perspective, but you got to play Detroit midweek. You probably should play Michigan midweek. You probably should play Marquette midweek. And you might have to play a 2-game and 3-day situation during spring break. And I think that, you know, that's going to be a substantial problem for Utah. It was a problem, you know, for Jacksonville when they were kind of the trailblazer down south. There's no question that it's tough, but, you know, that's kind of what comes with the territory of being a trailblazer.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, my overarching point with that was, like, shouldn't it be that teams have to play within two games of each other, two or maybe three games of each other in their regular season schedule, you know, before
I
they
would
get
certainly
in
advocate
play.
For that, because my thing is that I don't think coaches oppose midweek games,
which is a level playing field.
I think that they oppose midweek game in which they had, like, they don't like having to play someone on Wednesday if they played the previous Saturday and their opponent didn't. And that's where if you narrow the number of games and you reduce the number of weeks by pushing the start date later, just by point of reference, I promote the idea of starting practice the Tuesday after the Martin Luther King holiday and starting games the third weekend in February as early as that Thursday, because I think that Thursday night window is a really good media window. If you narrow the window to the third weekend in February through the first weekend in May, and then you mandate the teams play 14 games, but then limit them to playing 16, the likelihood that you're going to get equitable midweek matchups increases, and I think that that's the name of the game. That is what creating a mandate that will reduce the competitive imbalance is what is going to be necessary in order to get the coaches on board.
And, you know, you started this conversation with the look at, you know, how the conference, you know, over the past decade, how the conferences have shaken out and been, you know, I think we'd argue a positive for the sport in terms of, you know, we had a big staff debate last year around tournament time about, you know, the AQ system and how the conferences play a role in that. But, you know, these things are more tenuous than I think people realize.
The
conference affiliation, yeah. And you know, the schedule of, you know, you can say something about like, oh well, because of the you know, the Big Ten tournament is going to be on that weekend that it's on now. You know, that we're never going to be able to play a game that weekend against Hopkins or Maryland.
That might not be true.
But that might not be true. You know, there's been talk of the Big Ten, you know, moving their conference championship up a week, and that could potentially be this mythical date where Navy and Hopkins have this rivalry game that they can play, which would be great. But, you know, we've also heard rumblings of, you know, something that hasn't been voted on, you know, just at this point, I'd say just an idea of a topic of discussion about the ACC tournament changing its format so that the fifth-place team plays as part of the tournament, and you know, they spread the tournament over 2 weeks. You know,
so the idea there, correct if I'm wrong, is five would play four as part of a semifinal, and then four would play one and two would play three as part of, or I'm sorry, so five would play four as a quarterfinal on like Friday, then the following Sunday two would play three and one would play the winner of 5-4,
correct.
And then the following weekend the winner of those two matchups would play.
Yes.
Okay. So that's an interesting concept, and obviously it extends the ACC tournament and presumably would do so into the final week of the regular season. As I mentioned earlier, you know, right now, Syracuse, Duke, and Notre Dame already play on that weekend.
And they play Patriot League teams.
Who theoretically would lose their opponent unless six Big Ten teams were able to become available.
So, you know, there's a lot at play here. And even the Patriot League, you know, I think there's a big push at the Patriot League to add another team to make it a two divisional format, so you can have two balanced divisions. You know, it's something we've seen in football. I'm thinking of Big Ten football as a prime example there of, you know, the I guess leaders and legends divisions.
It's East and West now, but yes, we know what you're talking about.
Yeah, so
well, you mentioned something there that's a pet peeve of mine, and I kind of obliquely referred to it earlier. The downside to conference tournaments being the last week of the season is that if you don't make your conference tournament, you don't play the last week, the crescendo. You know what I mean? You don't even practice. If they're the
second, you
can actually
not play from the last week of April through
right the rest of the season. Your season ends last week in April.
It happened in 80 a few years ago.
Right.
Like, yeah.
So I would actually advocate for every conference tournament, if not every single one, being the second to last week, all of them ending by the second to last week. You can play earlier than that, but then opening up the last week of the regular season for a scheduled game so that if you don't make your conference tournament, you are at least practicing through the last weekend of the regular season. You're staying together as a team, because that is, you know, I will concede that if you're having a bad season, that would probably be a rough two-week stretch. But number one, it's really advantageous for the young players to get an additional week's worth of practice. And number two, it's the most fun week or 2 weeks of your college year. You know, the finals, when you're not in class as much and student body is like really, you know, the girls are laying out, everything like that. It's so much more fun. You know, you're getting your festival with some big name band on campus. Like, I think there's value in having the lacrosse season encompass that week. For sure, regardless of whether or not you qualify for your conference tournament.
Definitely. And, you know, with it could be a second life to your season, too. You know, if you're, you know, say we're using Navy Hopkins as kind of the example here for a lot of this stuff. Say Navy loses in the Patriot League Championship. They don't quite have the resume, but Hopkins is a really big high RPI win for them. You know, if they go into the last week of their...
We saw it this past year with Army, Army against Notre Dame.
Yeah, that was almost what got Army into the NCAA tournament. So it can add a breath of, you know, a breath of life to your season there at the end of the year. So in short, you know, we're talking about like this Navy Hopkins game not being on the schedule and how much, you know, it's just unfortunate, but it's such a, to limit the conversation to say like, and just kind of look at it at the base level of like, I can't believe these coaches are getting rid of these local rivalries. It's really not looking at the systemic issues that we've just laid out right here. And to my point earlier about, you know, the tenuous nature of the scheduling things, you know, frankly, who knows if, you know, all of the programs that are in college lacrosse are going to be in college lacrosse, you know, over the next 5 years. It's not unheard of for teams for programs to be dropped by their institutions. And if it happens to one of these conferences, and that basically makes a conference that's non-existent anymore.
Or less fatalistically, what if a team, an affiliate moves to a different conference?
Correct. There's many affiliates out there. You know, there's still independents that are out there. A lot of this stuff can change and have pretty big ripple effects, you know, throughout all of the Division I landscape.
Well, let's not be too negative, Matt. Let's end the podcast on a positive note. We're going to quickly run through some of our favorite new games and new to the 2018 season. Before we do that, you know, want to give a shout out to US Lacrosse, not necessarily new matchups, but a couple of new games being played at their venue. Penn Navy is a good one, and then Penn State Cornell is another good one too. So if you're in the area of Sparks, Maryland, you're going to want to check those two out.
And they've historically had some really good D2, D3 games as well. So hopefully they can kind of keep up that trend and, you know, just a way to put a spotlight on the other divisions of lacrosse that might not get the spotlight.
All right. So which game new to the 2018 season has you most excited?
Ooh, Syracuse Rutgers.
It's interesting because this was a Big East matchup that when Syracuse joined the ACC, they were selective with who they retained. You know, St. John's stayed on the schedule. I believe Providence and Rutgers did not. I believe Georgetown, that, you know, another traditional rival, also was asked for the program. It's pretty interesting from the slate. It's pretty interesting to see the Orange Brig, the Scarlet Knights, back on. But obviously, it speaks to the nice job Brian Brecht has done to build that program and make it so that it's a sought after game for the Orange, presumably.
Definitely, and you know, I think this should be a game that if you're scheduling for ESPN, this should be one that is on your radar to make this one happen. It's going to be just exciting. You know, you have two storied programs. You know, Rutgers just Syracuse just had its 100th year, I think, 2 years ago, and Rutgers had its 100th year last year. So two storied programs. Rutgers is, you know, clearly a team that everyone's excited about going into this year. Syracuse always has excitement around that program. There's just going to be fireworks for that game there.
So for me, I'm going to go a little bit off the board, but before I name it, a couple of worthy of honorable mention. So sticking with that Syracuse theme, they're also playing Navy, a team that we have spent about 40 minutes talking about. So we're not going to dive into that one.
It should be a two-year
two-year deal
for that game, the Syracuse-Navy game.
Princeton and Virginia, sparking back up.
I was surprised that I just associate those two so much with each other that you could have told me that they play every year and I would have believed you.
And then one that is certainly new and interesting, Towson taking on Duke. What do you know about this one? Do you know where and when?
I believe it's at Towson. You know, Towson has a kind of a rough go in terms of their home schedule with a lot of their, you know, Johns Hopkins, Loyola, the games that are going to bring a lot of crowd are away, or at least they're down the road, not on their campus. So this just kind of is going to bring a lot of fans to United Stadium there.
Before we move on from Duke, I just want to give a quick shout out to Coach John Donowski. In speaking with High Point head coach John Torpy last week, he was telling me a story about a conversation that he had with Dino with respect to scheduling. So their game was originally scheduled for Saturday, February 10th. We've already talked about that date. It's Navy, Maryland, Hopkins, Towson. High Point has a men's lacrosse alum who has graduated from Navy SEAL school and is being pinned on February 9th. Coach Torpy was invited to that ceremony and asked Coach Janowski if it would be feasible to move their game to February 8th, understanding how important this type of topic is to Coach Janowski. Coach Dino's response was perfect, Coach Dino. Hey, Coach Torpy, next time ask me a tough one. So shout out to one of the good guys in the game doing something good for one of his colleagues. But on to my, you know, kind of new game that I'm most excited about. You're going to have to stick with me because it's not, you know, super obvious, but I'm really excited for this Yale-Michigan game. And the reason is because Yale wasn't able to extend their series against Maryland, which has become one of the better games of the year, both in the NCAA tournament and in the regular season over the past 3 to 4 years.
A great recent rivalry with just crazy stuff happening at each game.
No question. And so, you know, bringing on the Wolverines, it's important for the Bulldogs RPI, you know, not only for their tournament selection feasibility. We saw them, you know, kind of be on the bubble last year, probably needed to win the Ivy League in order to get in. And obviously we're on the road at the Carrier Dome having won the Ivy League championship. But, you know, for the Bulldogs, this is a team that probably won't be a top five RPI squad the way Maryland has traditionally been under John Tillman. But coming off of last season, it might not be unrealistic to project them in the top 20, so they would be a quality win. And really, you know, for a Kevin Connery coach team, I expect that you're going to see the seeds of Maryland in these Michigan Wolverines. And depending on when this game is played, could be a nice bellwether for both programs.
I mean, your logic makes sense.
All right, Matt. Well, I think on that note, we're going to wind this down. We hope everybody had a safe and happy holiday. Make sure to check back to the Inside Lacrosse podcast on Friday as we kick off the November Division I men's lacrosse recruiting window with the Isle Recruiting Podcast. We've already had some big news this week that we will dive into. But until then, thank you for listening. Follow us on Twitter at @inside_lacrosse. On Instagram at Inside Lacrosse. And like I said, make sure to check out #TrueFallBall on Twitter and Instagram and on InsideLacrosse.com. We're out.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.